So I'll be talking about the work of the Vision Assessment Team today, and you've already seen a good part of it because the whole point of the Vision Assessment Team is to help support the other three teams and to feed information and analysis to them. So you will see some of the maps again that you've already seen, and I wanted to sort of talk about it a little bit of a different way. Some of our the things we've learned, some of the obstacles or considerations I think we need to have going forward, and also to give some credit to some of the outstanding work of some of the participants in our team. Our team is set up with a core group and then a number of supporting members. I'm not really quite sure of the distinction because everyone seems to be working hard, but I also wanted to point out that the people with the red asterisks there are actually serving on two teams. They're liaisons so that we have good feedback and communication between teams, and I think that's been really helpful. You've heard a little bit about all of these key parameters from the other talks. These are the initial key parameters. Most of the teams are planning to add some others as we move forward, but some of them are harder to acquire the data for, and we're going to have to do some more work to get them. So the initial key parameters, again, to remind you, for healthy habitat, biostimulation is a measure of nutrient over-enrichment. Bioassessment is a measure of the health of the bug community in the creek system. So it's a measure of, it actually reflects both habitat and water quality health. Riparian habitat health, in other words, the vegetation along the creek banks adjacent to the aquatic habitat. Toxicity and stream physical structure. For sustainable land management, right now we're talking about impervious surfaces and toxicity. There probably will be additional measures related to both urban and agricultural land management practices. And then clean groundwater, right now nitrate, total dissolved solids, with future additions related to other contaminants down the road. Okay, we've already kind of talked about this one in detail, characterizing imperviousness. I wanted to reiterate, this is Brandon Sanderson's work, and he did this work with a fairly short time frame and a very heavy workload, so we really appreciate his efforts. And as was mentioned, right now he was working in a small area in Santa Barbara, but the intent definitely is to move the scale of the work he was doing to a larger, to the entire region. And I think Roger did a nice job of summarizing this point that I wanted to make, that scale, especially when you're working in these geographic information system environments, is really critical to keep in mind. Roger pointed out, you know, the fact that you really don't even see some of our major urban areas, Santa Maria, Salinas, at this particular scale, and that's because the little sub-watershed areas they're sitting in are relatively large, or divided by two different areas. So they really don't show up. And as we do this type of work, it's really important that we stay really aware of what scale we're working on and what's important, what is the right scale for the decision we're trying to make. And I think that is a very important lesson that came out of this series of maps. And I think it applies for most of the work we're working on. So we need to really keep that in mind. Again, depending on the decisions you're making, this probably may be a more useful scale. These, I wanted to just reiterate what these are. These are little catchments, and they are developed through the National Hydrography Dataset, which is a USGS product. It's a fairly recent tool that's available to us, and I think what's really exciting about this particular tool is that each of those catchments is associated with a reach of stream. And they're attached in the database, which allows you to learn things about what is going on the land adjacent to or flowing to a point on a stream or a reach of stream. So it's what's going to enable us to basically attach some of this land use information to our stream information and pull the whole picture together. So it's a really remarkable timing because this really only was made available to us a year ago, and I think it's going to be the basis for a lot of the work we do with the assessment group. The assessment group has also worked on projects in developing supporting information. So there's key parameters that the teams are using to track our goals, but there's also just general information we need to understand our region better. And a really great example of that was done by Sandy Cheek and several other folks from the admin staff. And I want to really compliment them on their just, they just did it. They just had this amazingly proactive approach. They just got into the discharger database and did it because they realized that they didn't have the necessary geographical information stored with the permit data to make these linkages in the databases we're working with in the geographic framework. So they just went in and added that information. And the consequence is now we can make maps. In this case, this is, again, an interesting example of scale. This is the number of permits in each, this is called a hydrologic subarea. There's different mapping tools you can use, watershed areas, but this one happens to be a USGS product. So notice that the largest number of permits we have is here in probably representing vineyards, which is sort of a surprise when you first look at it. But then when you actually look at that by permits per acre, it's not quite as obvious, but still quite a bit considering that's, you know, the Paso Robles area, the Upper Salinas watershed. It gives an interesting framework, and also all of this data can be looked at in different levels of detail. You could look at different types of permits, for example, focus down in a water body, for example, and look at it in different ways. You've already seen a dazzling example of Cecile's work. I was terribly impressed with that. Cecile just has this great capacity for animation, which is a wonderful thing we're going to take advantage of. She's animated in many ways, but what she's doing that I think is really great is she's getting, well, first of all, she used existing data compilations. So this is big piles of data that we had gathered from various sources in the past. And she's been able to look at them in really fresh ways, in spite of the fact that some of these data sets, we literally have a stack of papers this high on the content of the data set. But by creating these incredibly just visual and usable tools to look at them, I think it just makes it so immediate what the issues are. And I think that's been a real great example of how sort of new technology can be used to increase our understanding. How did that happen? Whoops. Oh, you did it. Okay, you can do it. But I also wanted to point out that embedded in all of our goals is a message about trends. It says, and 20% will show positive trends in key parameters. That means we need to be able to track trends. We can't just assess something. We need to be able to show change. And she did this animation to look at some data to show change over time. And it's really interesting. So it starts back in the mid-80s. And again, you'll notice we're getting a lot more wells coming in over time. And what we're seeing here is the red dots. As the dots get larger, they're getting higher in terms of concentration. And once they hit red, they're exceeding the drinking water standard. And purple is more than twice the drinking water standard. So you can see we have some large, high areas developing. And the other thing that's interesting is we have continuity with these wells over time. So this is an old database that really shows a number of wells that we can track trends in over time, which is really nice to know. Why don't you hit it one more time? So again, could you stop it at the end, too? There's Santa Barbara area, Santa Maria area. There's a lot going on in sort of the Arroyo Grande area, in Morro Bay and then in Los Osos. And another interesting one that develops is downstream of the San Luis Obispo, probably wastewater treatment plant. See it coming in right there and then moving downstream. There it goes. Anyway, you all just got more information out of that database than... Or it just take a lot of effort to get it through going through stacks of paper. Let me put it that way. So I think it was a great tool. Thank you, Cecile. Okay. Could you put me back to PowerPoint? Thanks. Okay. Larry's done some really interesting work on beginning to characterize what's going on with related to land disturbance adjacent to our riparian corridors, our stream corridors. And I think what he's done is going to become a really, really useful component of our assessment work. So we basically wanted to look at potential risk from land uses that were occurring near stream systems. And so Larry used 30-meter imagery, so that's how precise it is, basically, to evaluate land uses within a 200-meter area from each bank of all of our stream corridors. This is from a document developed by the County of Santa Clara, and this is actually compiled from a number of different scientific references. So they looked at the literature and came up with a range of recommended riparian widths for protection of a number of different kinds of ecological functions. So some of these ranges are quite large. You can see, you know, bird habitat. Birds range widely within the area, so it's a large range of values. But after looking at this, Larry decided to use a buffer distance of about 200 meters, which would fall right in here, just to get an idea of what's going on within that distance of our streams. So this is the database that he used. It's called the National Land Cover Database. It's a USGS database that is revisited on a periodic basis. I think it's every 5 years they redo this imagery. So recalculate it. So we have the capacity to look at change over time using this imagery. Basically, you can see there's a wide number of land use categories. And this is the Santa Cruz area. You can see here's some urban development. It does include different intensities of urban development. This is row crop agriculture, grasslands, forested area. And Larry categorized those land uses in a really simple way in terms of whether they're developed or undeveloped. Now, recognize that anything he did this way, we could do in a different level of detail. For example, if we only wanted to look at urban types of development, we could view the data that way. So we could just select for, or just select for crops, for instance. But in this case, he did just developed versus undeveloped. And so basically, he was able to create these, they actually ultimately are 400-meter areas around the creek systems, and then look at whether those areas are developed or undeveloped. And the red here are of the, let me go back a slide, some of these red categories developed, and of course the green are not. And so this is another example of scale. Larry, the work is actually done at a high level of detail, but in the next slide you can see he's generalized out at a much larger scale. This is the percent of developed land within that 200 meters of stream bank by these watershed areas. And the red here represents from about 31 to 100% impact or developed. And it was interesting because the data was really skewed. There was a lot of, meaning there was a lot of riparian corridor that is in this area. These are more or less divided in quartiles. So the darkest green is only 1 to 2% impacted or developed. I shouldn't say impacted. And the darkest red ranges from 30 to 100%. And again, you can see a lot of the urban areas, Salinas Valley, Santa Maria, San Luis Obispo area.
Karen, what's interesting about that is reflecting upon how that would look if you were also comparing it to percent perviousness.
Very
within 200 meters, and you probably get two totally different pictures, because I would think that ag is deemed developed, but it still is very pervious.
Right. And you could do the same map and look at imperviousness adjacent to creeks. In other words, select only for those. You could use the imperviousness layer instead of the ones that he used, mm-hmm. and do the same exercise. So it would give you a different way of viewing urban impacts to riparian areas. I think the percent of the catchment or watershed is one way, but another way is what's going on. It's sort of like a near-field, far-field effect. You know, what's happening close and what's happening in the overall area. And I think both of those need to be considered. So this is really just that other, a different scale. Anyway, that was a really great exercise. I thought he did a great job on that. Okay, Dave in particular has been working really hard on combining some of how are we going to combine these key parameters into like indices of health. And I've actually gone over some of these ideas at past offsites, but just to remind you, we've been in the CCAMP program developing indices over the years, so we have several of these already, where we take a number of field measurements and combine them into a single score. So in this case, we took different measures that express some aspect of this biostimulation problem and combined them into a single number, single index score. And that biostimulation score would become one of several that would go into another score that would express aquatic health. So if the waters doesn't have a nutrient problem, but it's toxic, you know, those still are measures of aquatic health and they need to be considered together. So how this is going to end up working is what we've been working on recently, and it's going to be challenging. There's a lot of things to think about as you do it. And it's actually been a really, we have a great start for it because we've developed mapping tools already that combine these indices and track them up our watersheds using the GIS tools.
Are you guys developing this on your own?
Yeah. We have a lot of talent.
I mean, no one else is doing something like this in California or elsewhere?
You know, it's interesting because that NHD data set just came out, and what it has created is this capacity to sort of track things upstream or route things through watersheds. And we just got back from a conference, and there wasn't a lot of work. There's a national conference going on yet, but I think in the next couple of years you're going to see a lot of this type of thing popping up here and there. But
Karen, what is NHD?
I'm sorry, that was the National Hydrography Data Set I mentioned earlier. That's the USGS product, because it's pretty new. You already saw our toxicity index, and I think, who showed it? Dan showed it already. This is another example of an index that, again, combines multiple types of data, in this case from multiple species, because we had four different test species. And then there's different measurements. So there's lethal effects, sublethal effects, the amount of the toxicity, the magnitude. So that's already been combined into that index approach. This is basically from our poster from last year, which was sort of this concept of when you have something identified as a problem at a site scale, associating upstream reaches with that problem, but there's this issue of how far does that go upstream? And this is something we have to deal with all the time, like with the 303D listing process. We use site scale data to identify a problem, but then we list reaches as impaired. So that's what we're working on right now. And Dave has a draft website that he's been developing that basically is going to shift the way we structure the website so that it's more based on the vision goals and key parameters. So basically, you would be able to drill into the detail of the key parameters, you know, clicking on aquatic habitat health, and then it's coming into a series of maps that score the region overall. And then you would be able, for instance, to click on any individual index and get specific information about that index. This happens to be a map that he's developed on invertebrate health. So he has the underpinnings of this working, and we're doing some fine-tuning on it right now.
Karen?
Yeah.
Over here. What is that map showing us?
This is Invertebrate Health Index, so this is our index of biotic integrity. And when they are scoring badly, it's red. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's like I said, we're using the data to move upstream. In areas that have some signs of impairment are yellow. Good condition are green. And then the gray is not assessed. Now, one thing that we're also looking at is using some of the data on just land uses, is it disturbed or not disturbed, to start looking at these upper watershed areas we don't currently have actual data on, CCAMP data, but we know whether they're disturbed or not, so we can perhaps begin saying, we have no evidence, there's a problem here, maybe we should be considering that they're most likely undisturbed and healthy. So.
Is this up and running, or is it?
It's on the web, but it's not for public.
Do you know about when it will be public? Roughly.
I give it a couple months still.
Oh, okay. Great.
Yeah. Would you like us to let you know?
Yeah.
Okay. So for the assessment team, by next year, we're hoping to have a state of the region report, a small, glossy report, sort of summarizes things. In one short document, the website showing key parameter assessments. I said a couple months, it says next year, but. Information management system that I alluded to earlier, populated with the initial data layers on our key parameters. And we're working on a wiki website, which is the same software as Wikipedia, so you can all contribute to it to document our process. So we're hoping to build that out as we move forward. And now I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Roger Briggs.
And Karen, as I look at this map up here, and I see that 53% of this watershed is unassessed, and I think you touched on that a little bit, what's your projection for when you think you'll have 100% assessment done? How many years out is that going to...
Well, there's several ways we can do assessment. Using some of the imagery data, for instance. And I just talked about the... What is that?
It's not breathing.
I think we're going to have to take a different approach in upper watersheds. Just because our sampling program doesn't get us up there, it's impractical, difficult. What we'd like to do for upper watersheds is do sort of a risk-based assessment based on all the, you know, land use information we can get from our various GIS systems. And then perhaps come in with some kind of a randomized design and test how well we're doing. In other words, if we went in and randomly tested the area we made assumptions about, say, well, we think this area is healthy, then we can go in and do a randomized, say, maybe just using benthic invertebrates, randomized look and say, what's the percent that we're wrong? And that way we get some error around that risk-based assessment. So that's kind of what we're thinking about for the watersheds. And then starting not this next year, but the year after next, we're going to start implementing more higher watershed sites through the new fund. So that will help improve assessment in those upper, sort of middle and upper reach areas, because we've been focused on lower ends of tributaries for the most part with our program, and I think that next layer of sites is going to really help improve sort of the detail of the assessment. But that, we're starting that with our next full watershed rotation, which will be the year after next.
Okay.
Karen,
I had a question for you about that. Isn't it true that we'll never have 100% coverage, but we'll get to a point where we have coverage, enough coverage, so that our extrapolation is acceptable and by some measure, statistical measure?
Right, I think it's that idea that we can go back and test how right we are in making those assessments.
Yeah.
That would, at some point, do that. So, you know, because
this is really, like I said, it's underpinning the way the 303D process works as well. You're making the assumption that some length of stream, upstream of problem site, also has that problem. Mm-hmm. But of course, at some point in there, you're probably wrong.
Right.
Or it's not as much of a problem. But it's also, like I said, sort of risk-based. You do the best you can. Right now, we're looking at tools that he's working on. How far you let these things go upstream, looking at some of those disturbance numbers that, for example, like Larry was using. So maybe we let it go upstream until it reaches a certain change in that disturbance and then we turn it off so we don't know anymore. Mm. So that's kind of a complication in getting this cleaned up.
Any other questions for Karen? Thanks, Karen.